Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is the Golf Under Par podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy McCullough. We are on a journey to find the information that's going to help you play the best golf of your life. Join us now as we dive in. Welcome, everybody, to the Golf Under Par podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy McCullough, here with a very special guest, Tony Gentilcore, and it looks like his cat. And,
yes, my cat just made an appearance. So that I know people can't see because they only have audio here, but my cat just, you know, popped in my lap and wants to be part of this.
Yeah, wouldn't be the first time for me either for my cats to wander in front of the video or something like that. Anyway, so back to the intro. Tony is the owner of Core, which is a fitness studio, and he's also an author. If you find a fitness magazine or website or wherever, you have probably read an article from Tony, because he is all over the place and has written thousands of articles. So thank you, Tony, for coming on. And
my pleasure. My pleasure. I might be your first guest that has never gone under par in their golf game.
Oh, I doubt
above
it.
Par.
I've had a few other people that aren't golfers either. So,
okay. Well, I'm in that camp. So, you know, but yeah, thank you for having me. As I love talking shop, and you know, I know we'll be talking about training rotational athletes and whatnot. So looking forward to it.
Yeah, exactly. So obviously you just said you weren't a golfer. How many times have you gone out and played or
anything? I have a few old time friends who back home, which is back in New York. I'm in Boston, but back in New York, who are golfers. I golfed with them way back in the day, like once or twice. So I think I've played actual golf maybe twice. And then there's a smattering of mini golf and maybe a couple par three courses too. But yeah, I can count on one hand for sure.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, that doesn't mean you don't know the human body and how to get the best out of it. So that's exactly why we got you on here. But before we kind of get into a little bit of that, I'd love to chat with you a little bit about what you've been sharing on some of your social media here of late. Sure. Within the last month or so, I think it was. You were having a back issue and
working
on that. So
I call it a more of a back niggle.
Yeah.
I like to lift heavy things. And I always just chalk it up to it as like, inevitably it is going to happen. You're going to have a niggle, whether it be the knee, the shoulder, the low back, the ankle. In this case, what I was doing was nothing remotely sexy. I was bending over to pick up the barbell to do an offset landmine row. So basically the landmine was to my left. And I was just going to hold it on my left side to do a row. And then all of a sudden I bent over and my back just seized up on me. So definitely musculature. But I would say it was like a good 3 or 4 days of, heating pad and a little every time I was moving around.
Yeah.
But certainly I didn't take that as a case. I didn't use it as an excuse not to still try to do something in the gym. So I think within the week, I was definitely back to my regular training. I mean, I was training all along, but just an annoying, stupid back niggle.
Yeah, niggle. I like that word. So, I remember when I turned 30 a few years back, and it was like the same weekend. And no, it was when I turned 31 because the pandemic had just started. And so I turned 31 and then, you know, just a lazy weekend. It's like, oh, I got basically a free weekend off of nothing doing going on because everything's closed. And so just sat around and whatnot. And I think it was the Monday I got up and I was like, oh, I can't move my back. So I had a little back niggle that way, that time too.
Yeah.
So.
You know, and I have clients and athletes and it happens. It happens. I mean, certainly nothing that no one listening has never had to deal with, but certainly not a serious injury. Like I didn't herniate a disc or,
right.
It wasn't anything debilitating, but But anyone who's active, remotely active, I mean, like I said, inevitably it's something that just kind of like tosses you a little bit of curveball, and you know, you work around it for a couple of days and then you're back to normal. Thankfully that was the case. That would have, you know, I had a more significant injury last summer, like at the start of the pandemic, where I ruptured my Achilles.
Oof.
So that was an actual injury.
Right.
That I got the sympathy votes from the wife on that one. But yeah, that was coming up on a year now. So my year anniversary will be, I think, late May. But yeah, the back stuff was something I always like to showcase to people, like, you know, if you're injured, you can still train, you know, and like, I call it the trainable menu. You know, I really think it's an important message to showcase to people that, you know, you can train pretty much around any injury. You know, just find what you can do rather than focusing on what you can't, and let's get after it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about here with you is, you know, where do you go with getting people to figure that out a little bit? How did you kind of figure it out with what you could do that day or that week?
Oh boy. I originally heard the term, I think a colleague of mine, Chris Chase, on Mike Robertson's podcast, was the first person I heard say the term. And I believe Chris at the time was the strength and conditioning coach for USC baseball. Now I believe he's somewhere in the NBA. I don't know what team he's with, but very, very smart, bright guy. And when he said the term and I heard him say it, I was like, oh my God, that is amazing. Like I need to kind of somehow use this term, and I like to give credit. So Chris is the one I heard it from first. And this is like probably four or five years ago. And even at my days at Cressy Sports Performance, where, you know, I worked with a lot of baseball players there, and we had many players come in post Tommy John surgery or any litany of injuries, or and we try to showcase them. Yeah, okay, you don't have access to your throwing arm right now, but you have access to your lower body. You have access to your non-injured arm. You have access to your core. Let's train the heck out of that and like still make some progress and give you a training effect. And that way, when you are out of your sling and then you are like starting the rehab, I've always found that the rehab goes a little bit more seamlessly. I mean, it's never a linear line, of course. There's always like ebbs and valleys and flows and
stock market.
But yeah, you of all will know, any physical therapist know, like, you know, everyone thinks it's a linear path, but it's remote. It's not close to that.
Nope.
So, you know, with our players and athletes and our clients at Cressy Sports Performance, it was an important message. And there's something that has stayed with me throughout the years, whether it was my own training. Thankfully, I don't get injured all the time. I know I sound like I'm a walking, you know, ball of dysfunction.
But
even with my clients, like many, and they kind of know how I roll. Like they might say, so, I mean, I know when to, like, as you would say, call a mulligan and like, okay, let's pump the brakes. Let's take a day off. Like, listen to our body. But more often than not, outside of like a really serious injury that involves like an axe or a chainsaw, I don't know, like we dismemberment, we can train around that injury, usually. And, you know, Steve Tripp, who's a coach here in New England, he has a training facility outside of Providence, Rhode Island. A few years ago, I want to say he ruptured his bicep, or maybe it might. But anyway, he basically said, okay, I don't have use of my arm, but I'm gonna train the heck out of my squat. And he used safety squat bar, and he basically came up with he's insane. He's one of the strongest humans I've ever known or come across. So he devised a way where he was like squatting like five times a week, and you know, he's like, I'm gonna make lemonade out of lemons. I'm gonna train something hard. But going back to the main umbrella theme, I just think, you know, if you're training through an injury or more specific around an injury, I do feel it makes the rehab much quicker, just because you are kind of maintaining some semblance of training effect, but strength too. And I just think it's an important message for people to hear.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I talked, you know, one of the first visits with everybody is always, okay, well, we got to get some blood flow to the area, because blood flow is how healing process happens.
Sure.
Guess what?
Sure.
Going through a training menu, training stuff that you can train, even though you're injured or whatever. That gets
it's a nice flow. Reframe. That's... It's a beautiful reframe. Like I'm married to a psychologist, so she's had a lot of insight and a lot of inspiration for, you know, how I can better use my words and how I can reframe things. Like I've really gone out of my way to take out words like broken, we need to fix you, you're dysfunctional. Yeah. I really don't like using, they're omitted from my vocabulary altogether. Particularly if I'm working with somebody who's coming off an injury, like, yeah, you're injured.
Yep.
Or I say non-health, whatever term we want to use, but it's just a really nice reframe to say, we're still going to train pretty hard and pretty aggressively, and just focus on what you can do. And I think people appreciate that. And then they soon realize that, their injury isn't quite so, debilitating as they think.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've all seen the trainer or the therapist that, you know, they do their assessment and like, oh, that's terrible. Oh, that's terrible.
All,
oh,
all that, the time, man, yeah.
That's really bad. That's dysfunctional. And it's like,
yep.
Okay, let's, you're trying to build people up too at the same time, you know? So you do have to be careful with your words, and whatnot. So I do like that thought process of, you know, avoiding saying broken, you know, like I got to fix this, or we got to fix that, or whatever.
And I think it's important because like, I think fitness professionals are fall prey to this, of course, but regular people too, to think that, you know, asymmetry is bad. And that, you know, we have to fix everything because, you know, one shoulder is more internally rotated than the other, or you might have a little anterior pelvic tilt, or, you know, you lack scapular upward rotation. I always tell people like, it's completely normal to lack certain things. Like we don't live in textbooks. Like we're not made in textbooks. Like textbooks are standards, you know, but certainly like whether or not it applies to you is going to be dictated on the sport you play, like your body type, like your structure, your anatomy, not to mention your injury and health history. So I really try to instill in people that, you know, you don't live in a textbook. So the standard that we have to be symmetrical and perfect statues of David, is just a really stark, unattainable metric to try to model our programming and training by.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, especially as you go in with golfers, where
you're constantly
doing this same movement and whatnot, you get a lot of asymmetries, kind of inherently from that. And a lot of times those asymmetries are what makes good golfers good golfers.
Sure. Same thing for baseball players. There's a lot of asymmetries that are completely normal and within the confines of the sport. As you noted, sometimes makes them good at their sport. A colleague of mine who you might be familiar with, Nick Tumanello, he recently came out with a really good course I'm taking myself through right now. It's called the strength symmetry evaluation. And he references research saying between left and right side or between limbs, the bulk of the research out there will say anything more than 15% difference, strength discrepancy, can probably be a problematic scenario. Now, we don't need to like cut corners a bit. Well, what about 14%? What about 17%? It's like the 15, but there's gotta be some like line drawn in the sand. Like 15% is the research, much of the research will back that up. If you see that, you know, it's information. I wouldn't say it's a red flag right out of the gate, but if we're talking like a 20% gap or even 25, then yeah, that's something we're probably going to want to address. But if it's, you know, 10% difference in terms of strength or access to range of motion or anything of that nature, I just tell my people it's normal. That is not something we need to spend the bulk of our time on. Like, I think it's more important that we get you a little bit stronger and we kind of, you know, get you access to a little bit more movement variability. You know, as you noted, like you work with a lot of golfers. I mean, they do the same repetitive motion over and over and over and over and over again. So every time I've worked with golfers, it's like showing them like, okay, what you do on the golf course is what's going to get you better at golf. What we do in the weight room is not supposed to emulate golf.
Exactly.
you know, there's certainly things we want to, there's metrics we want to improve to help you hit a golf ball further, or like, let's open up your hips so you're not, you know, hurting your lower back anymore. Or let's improve your T-spine mobility to help you get more whip in your rotation, or whatever we want to talk about. But really, every time I've worked with golfers, it's like, let's do stuff that you're not used to doing. Let's get you out of, let's do more frontal plane work. I mean, they get a ton of rotation as it is. But I'm not necessarily going to be loading that rotation, per se. Like you've seen all the gimmicky YouTube videos where like they'll have their club attached to a cable system.
Yeah.
And they're standing on an unstable surface and they're doing their golf swing. I'm like, you're not improving anything.
You're improving your ability to stand on an unstable surface and swing some.
Yeah, if you want to be good at that, go for it. Fine. and it's funny because I know Mike Boyle's talked about this. I mean, Eric Cressy's talked about it. I've talked about it. I mean, we could take a golfer and we can compare their program to a football player, and 90% of it is going to be the same. Yeah. 100, like both are going to deadlift, both are going to squat, both are going to throw med balls. Both are going to do farmer carries. Like the idea, the objective is to, you know, increase strength and you know, get mobility where in the appropriate areas we need mobility, stiffen them up where they need to be stiffened up. So yes, hopefully they can, you know, perform well on the golf course and hit a ball further and not get beat up and, you know, less wear and tear in the joints. You know, there's no, like, I don't, like, whenever I've worked with the golfers, like, I need a golf-specific program. I'm like, I'll say, okay, cool. Well, I'll write you a golf specific program. But in my head, I'm just writing a strength program based off what I feel is going to help them get stronger and perform better on the golf course. And, you know, I know this is nothing new to your ears, but, or probably even your listeners' ears, but, yeah, to me, there's really no such thing as a baseball specific program or a golfing specific program. I think one of the best analogies I ever heard with regards to baseball, for example, is Eric Schoenberg, who used to be one of the head physical therapists that worked at Cressy Sports Performance. Yeah, now he's down in Florida with Eric. I remember, I think he had a parent ask, I need a program to work on arm care, like for my kid who's a pitcher. Like, we need a program really specific on his right arm, because that's what he, and like Eric was like, well, you don't just throw a baseball with your arm. Like, the entire body is involved in that process. Yeah. So that could be go for golfers too. I mean, golfers are very, they want rotational power, and it's like, okay, you don't just use your core. I mean, it's a big component, of course, but I mean, your core isn't just your abs. It isn't just your hips. It's anything that's not an appendage, really. Yeah, I know I'm rambling, but.
No, it's all good. I agree. The, you know, and over the last few years, I think in golf particularly, you're seeing a lot about like ground reaction forces. And I think baseball's sure. been on that same kind of whatever line, path.
Yeah, and it's like strength is, I mean, there's the point where someone is strong enough. So when I say getting somebody stronger, like, I'm not training power lifters per se. Like, that is not my job. I'm going to get them really strong in the barbell lifts. Like, that's not what I'm implying. I'm just implying that, I mean, a lot of times, especially with my higher level athletes, whether they're baseball, golf, basketball, it's a lot of times my job as their coach is to pump the brakes and be like, listen, you're strong enough. Like, you trap bar deadlift 405 pounds for reps. Like, you are strong. You getting your trap bar up to 500 pounds is not going to make you jump 6 inches higher. It's probably not going to make you hit a golf ball 100 yards further, you know, but there's an inherent risk of like more injury because the amount of work it's going to take for you to get to that level. So when I say I want to get somebody stronger, yeah, it's about force application, rate of force development. And there's two ways of doing it. There's, you know, the getting stronger component, lifting weights. And then there's a plyometric component of like moving weights faster, moving your body faster. No, that's where we talk about kettlebell swings or med ball throws. And, you know, we can have a conversation on Olympic lifts and stuff like that. I don't do a lot of Olympic lifts with my athletes just because I don't have a lot of experience myself with them. Yeah. I find I can get a lot of my power training in quotations, with med ball stuff, with, sled sprints or with kettlebell swings. and stuff like that. And I find most of the time, where people are going to get more power is it's just getting a little bit stronger and putting more force into the ground to be able to, you know, swing a golf ball harder and be able to sprint for faster and get out of the gate or jump higher. So, yeah.
So, yeah. And then I agree with that. And I don't tend to go with most Olympic lifts because most of the time those people, I mean, that's a sport in itself, right?
Sure.
So
sure.
It takes a lot of practice and whatnot and skill inherently to do that. But do you tend to lean more towards like more unilateral work or single leg work versus double leg work, or?
I would say I'm probably pretty in the middle when it comes to that stuff. I'm certainly not someone who's anti barbell squatting or anti deadlifting. However, I guess the caveat with me is like, I'm not worried about people using a straight bar and pulling off the floor, like doing a conventional deadlift or any of that. Like most of my clients do trap bar deadlifts.
Yeah.
I just think they're a more spine friendly, safer way of deadlifting. And even with regards to squatting, I have a safety squat bar. I have a Duffalo bar. There's even like barbell friendly, that back friendly ways of squatting.
Yeah.
And when it comes to single leg work, of course I love single leg work. Most of our lives, whether we're walking or playing sport, is single leg dominant. So it only makes sense to train that capacity. So whether we're talking, back foot supported, like where we're doing like Bulgarian split squats, or we're doing one legged RDLs, I go out of my way to really kind of like balance both. I'm a big strong advocate of like, okay, I'm not like pro bilateral and like anti-unilateral or pro, you know, unilateral, anti-bilateral.
Right.
It's like, let's train both. I just find it silly when you get on Twitter or Facebook. And that's the stuff that people are arguing about. And it's like, why?
Right.
Like, it's really, I mean, what you do is really contingent on the individual you're working with, like what they need more, what he or she needs more of. But more often than not, like they need both. And that's kind of how I approach it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that makes sense. You know, and that's kind of
not a sexy answer, I know, but, I try not to, I'm not very contrarian. The human body is the human body. You know, there's the variation comes from the assessment, and even then, like the point of my assessment is to figure out what variation of those lifts, you know, dictate the stance, even the type of lift that we're doing. Cause not everyone is built to, squat very deep. Okay, I'll have you squat to above parallel. Like, you know, we'll just use what you have access to. And then maybe down the road, we might get a little bit deeper, or maybe we won't. I mean, my expectation isn't that everyone has to, you know, squat the exact same way and deadlift the exact same way. You know, I even kind of lean into more asymmetrical stances when I have people squat and deadlift. So there might be a point where, you know, they might have a stagger stance and maybe their right foot is more externally rotated than their left. I kind of figure that stuff out during their initial assessment. And I actually lean into more of the asymmetries, and because we are structurally asymmetrical. So it's not to say that I might not need to, I might address it and say, okay, well, that's a pretty significant asymmetry. We might want to bring you a little bit back more toward the middle, but more often than not, if I find a stance with their squat, for example, where, you know, it might be a little bit asymmetrical and it just feels more stable and powerful and it's less painful, I'm going to lean into it and use it.
Yeah. And so you're basing that off of the, what you find on the assessment and not sure. Necessarily to get like some kind of result out of it by doing the asymmetrical stances.
Yeah. I don't like to give like, cause I know, I mean, I've taken the FMS course. I mean, I took it years ago.
Yeah.
I took it back in 2014. I mean, there's some things about the FMS that I like, the functional movement screen. And there's things about it I don't like. And one of the things I don't like is just like making people a number. Cause then they think they're that number. And then all they're worried about is like, I want to make my two a three, you know, three being perfect, two being passable. And really the goal is passable on any, on the whole screen. It's like, if you're a two, you're actually pretty good. Like, that's actually phenomenal. And even if you're a one, it doesn't mean like you're a ball dysfunction. It's like, I mean, if you're a zero and there's pain, like that definitely is a red flag, but, so I don't like using that sort of system or anything similar where people start to define themselves by the number they're given, like, oh, you're a two on this movement, or, you know, I just don't like that connotation. So I honestly, like when I assess people, like there's some table stuff I do, like I put them on the assessment table and I'm looking at, you know, active and passive hip range of motion, hip flexion, hip external, internal rotation. I'm seeing what I can do, what they can do. I'm trying to see if there's a discrepancy there. But honestly, I get them standing up and like moving. I say, show me your squat, show me your hip hinge. And then that's when I start to coach them up and I start to ascertain, you know, what stances or widths or hand position, or even what barbells we're going to use for those individuals. That's where the individualization comes in. Like I said, every one of my clients is doing some form of squatting, deadlifting, pushing, pulling. It's just what variation of those lifts you're doing is where the individualization comes in.
Yeah. Well, let's take this conversation back to where we started with the low back pain, and let's talk.
We got a little off track.
let's go. Just talking a little bit about, you know, some of your favorite things, to kind of help people, you know, golf, we have a high issues with back pain. You know, we hear it in all the professional sports, and I came across a statistic that says, you know, more than a third of golfers after a round of golf experience back pain.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some tips that you have maybe that people can include in their training or whatever to, we'll say, offset that or help minimize and only have niggles rather than a, you know, more.
Yeah, I think the easiest, my easiest entry point to that is the McGill 3. So I'm a big fan of teaching, particularly like, yes, planks, but even more specifically, like the bird dog and the dead bug. To me, it's a great entry point to teach core activation, spinal stiffness. Because to me, if you can't control slow, you're not going to control fast.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I'm not someone who's like opposed to training rotation or training lateral flexion. I think we should train those, especially if they're part of the sport. I mean, we don't play golf in a perfectly upright posture.
Right.
We don't play any sport in a perfectly upright posture. But in terms of like back pain, you know, there has to be like a base level of like entry point. Like, you know, if you can't be successful here, doing a bird dog correctly or a dead bug correctly, and if those hurt your back because you're moving through your back too much, or you're just not performing the exercises correctly, then that's a problem. So that's the entry point. And for many, 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 many people, like that oftentimes is the fix. And then, cause that's teaching them context. It's teaching them, okay, this is what a quote unquote neutral spine is, a stable spine, get it stronger there, build some endurance there. And then we can start loading it with our deadlifts, our single leg work. Then we can start adding in a little rotation where now where you're getting your rotation a little bit more from your hips and not just your lower back. Cause it hurt before, now it doesn't. You know, and then we can work on your thoracic extension and rotation. So now a lot of people are just locked up in that area. So they have to move from somewhere and they get it from their lower back. So a lot of times you just got to kind of look above and below the joint that hurts. You know, that's probably where they need to kind of work on a little bit more mobility. And with the low back, really the name of the game is stiffness and stability. You know, that's the entry point. And then once they're there, then we can kind of play around with, okay, now let's train lateral flexion, let's train rotation, and let's pick up the speed a little bit. So that's generally how I approach a lot of my low back issues, particularly when I'm working with rotational athletes.
Yeah. And I like that. That's true. You know, number of times I've made the mistake of, oh, you know, they're an athlete and they probably can handle this. We'll just jump right into, let's say it's like, you know, maybe a little bit more advanced, like maybe a pal off press or even just like going into deadlifting and realizing, oh wait, they can't actually control the neutral spine very well. And all right, we got to regress back to the mat.
I'll tell you what, like it's very rare like when I actually screen for it, it's very rare that somebody can do a really good bird dog.
Yeah.
And the next layer from that is a push-up. You know, I've had major league baseball players come in. I'm like, you can't do a push-up. I mean, they're obviously very great compensators, and I'm not making fun of them, of course, but
right.
if there's pain present when somebody is doing a push-up, I'm going to fix their push-up. The push-up to me, I'm not assessing their upper body strength. I am assessing their lumbo-pelvic control. And more often than not, like it is actually a very rare occurrence when somebody walks in and I look at their push-up and they are performing it well. I'm a pretty hands-on coach, and I'll put them in the position. I was like, okay, now you need to own this position that I have you in right now. And I'll start tapping their abs. I'll start tapping their glutes. And I was like, own it, like corkscrew your feet and get more tension. Because that's the thing too, is a lot of people fail to realize how much tension is needed to, protect the body, particularly when lifting heavy things. Like we want a fair amount of tension involved. I don't want someone to be loosey goosey when I'm loading them up on a deadlift or a squat. These rudimentary exercises like the dead bug and the bird dog and these push-ups, that's where I'm building context. Cause if they can't ramp up their tension there and do those movements well, there's no way when I load them in any capacity that they're going to do well there. So, and I understand that these drills are not, they're pretty inane. They're very vanilla. You know, I don't understand this term vanilla either. Like vanilla is a flavor. Like it's, to me, I like vanilla.
Yeah.
But you know, I think people tend to roll their eyes at a bird dog and a dead bug. Oh my God, I do these all the time. No, I went to PT, I do them. But then when I ask them to perform them, they're awful. And then they're not even feeling them in the right areas. Like I want, like when somebody does a dead bug, that to me is like anterior core central. I want them to emphasize the exhale. I want them to like get all the air out. I want them to get their ribs down. I want them to feel their anterior core, their abs turn on to the point where they're shaking. To me, I'm like, that shaking is good. To me, if you're shaking, you're doing it correctly. And it's that aha moment, like their eyeballs pop up. Like, oh my God, like this is really hard. I was like, yeah, that's the dead bug. Like if you do it correctly, yes, that's what we want. And then if you can't do it here, there's no way you're going to do it when I put a barbell on the front of your shoulders to do a front squat. So it's important to hammer home the basics with your athletes and your Gen Pop clients, because that's where we build context.
Yeah. I mean, you look at, you know, all the experts in the world, it oftentimes comes down to just their focus on the basics and being so good at that. And going back to what you were saying, you know, about seeing all these people, you would think, oh, high level athlete or whatever, they should be really good about doing this. And then you go and see, and it's like, wow. I remember screening in PT school, you know, a couple major league teams, we were mostly going through FMS and some other screens that our professor had kind of developed along with it, and just being like, man, I move better than you do. I should be a major league pitcher. Like,
yeah, if only it were that easy. Yeah.
Right. But I don't throw the ball 98 miles per hour. So,
right. And that's the thing too. We can't assume either. That's a big
correlation.
I don't like those numbers, because like there's little correlation with those. You're right. Yeah. You know, and like we said earlier, like a lot of what makes these guys successful is that asymmetry. And if you're going to try to fix it, like, I don't know like if you want to do that. It's important to assess. I just think we get too caught up in the weeds when it comes to assessing. I don't like putting people under a microscope and making them feel like there's this judgy connotation with assessment. I very much want the assessment to feel like a training session, so they feel like they're getting something out of it, that I'm not just being like a judgy jerk. And I'm like, oh, this is wrong. Cause it doesn't do anyone any favors.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we've all been to, you know, the doctor or whoever it may be, and they run you through a few things, and then they're like, okay, have a great day. And you go, what did I get out of this? You didn't really help me at all. Right. So I think like your thought process, the assessment still,
kind of
making them work, making them feel like they're doing something.
And with the low back stuff, like to me, far be it for me to like, to like roll my eyes at somebody's pain. Like if someone has back pain, they have back pain. Okay. Number one, I want to find out, okay, what positions or movements exacerbate it. So with golfers, I mean, it's a lot of like, they're going to have one sided back pain depending on if they're left-handed or right-handed. A lot of times it's going to be that back hip, you know, so it might be lack of a hip internal rotation on the other side. It might be because their thoracic spine is not, they don't have a lot of access there. Again, when there's pain present, I'm always going to peel back the onion a little bit more. Cause then again, I want to find out, okay, what exactly bothers it? What ramps it up? If we do this, like, can we do exercises that where that pain threshold doesn't get above a 3? I don't know if you do the same thing where it's like, I like that scale, like 1 to 10, 10 being like jaw just bit off your left arm. One being like, you know, I like the number 3, you know, like during the session and the day after a session. If it gets above a 3, like that is information. So it might be a loading issue. It could be a positional issue, of course, but a lot of times I think as fitness professionals, we overthink things like, okay, what correctives do I have to add in to fix this? Where it's like, no, like look at your program. It just might've been too much load, too much volume for that session. So ramp it back a little bit, slow it down. Like tempo, it might've been a tempo, like, you know, like joints, like tempo. So, you know, time and time again, if someone's knee hurts or their back hurts or whatever, you know, during a deadlift, for example, it's like, I'm not just going to like, okay, your back hurts, we're not going to deadlift. It's like, let's slow it down. Let's do a 3 seconds up, 3 seconds down. Does it hurt? And you'll be surprised in how it does. That does not hurt when you slow people down. Or even just like cutting down the range of motion. Like, again, I alluded to this, the squats earlier, where it's like, okay, this goblet squat hurts your back. All right. Okay. Well, let's not squat as deep. Let's maybe go to parallel. Does that take away your pain? Yeah. Okay. Well, let's squat to that then. Let's own that, do a lot of volume there, and then we can maybe work our way back down. So I think as fitness professionals, we kind of like gloss over the obvious, where it's like, if someone's in pain, look at your program, look at the volume and maybe tweak that rather than adding in all these correctives and more correctives and this that no one's going to do. And that's the stuff that people roll their eyes at, especially if you're working with athletes. They don't want to feel like they're going to a rehab session. They want to go to a training session. So I think a lot of times, like we gloss over the obvious. It's like, okay, well, the more I can make it feel like a strength and conditioning session and not corrective purgatory, we're doing them a better service, I believe.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, I think one of the big things that I see with a lot of, I don't know if necessarily young, but just with people in general, it's like, oh, that hurts, I'm not going to do it. And like, okay, it's sometimes it's just like, okay, like you said, change the range of motion.
It's so abstract. It's so, because like when you start talking about that pain threshold, like I'm a wimp. Like my wife is not. Like her pain threshold is different than mine. So my 3 might be her 1. You know, my 8 might be her 3. Like, who? I mean, maybe that's this big discrepancy. But, you know, there is an education involved. Like, to me, I'm like, a lot, especially I'm working with the people coming in through rehab, like golfers in the past I've worked with, low back pain. You know, you're right, because a lot of them, they get scared or they get reticent. They're like, oh, I feel it there. I shouldn't do that. To me, I'm like, we kind of have to flirt with that pain threshold, because that's the only way you're going to get better. Because then the flip side of everything is people underload themselves and they never get better, you know, to the point where they're like, their pain threshold up here is like this level, but they're training so far below it that they're never going to get better, because they're not tinkering or flirting with that pain threshold. So to me, as long as they don't go above a 3, they can stay at a 3. I'm fine with that. And we're just going to do a ton of volume just below that pain threshold. And that way, that's going to bump their threshold up a little bit higher. And then we work on our way up. So that's how I approach it. I think it takes a lot of education and repeating, and I hate repeating myself, but you know, but that's part of the job, just to be very repetitive with your message.
Yeah. I remember somebody told me, you know, they only learn about a quarter of what you say. You only remember about a quarter of what they say. So it's like, okay, so if I just repeat the same thing 4 times, they're going to get it once. Right.
So, that's a good way of putting it, right?
But yeah, I oftentimes use an analogy with people here. We're close to the Blue Ridge, Shenandoah Valley. And so I say people go on hiking a lot and say, all right, if you go hiking, you see a beautiful landscape, you're not going to walk yourself off the edge of a cliff. So you're not going to go past that three or four is what I usually say people. So you're gonna get to that edge, you're gonna flirt with it, like you said, and then you're gonna back off. You'll take your picture, you'll get to enjoy the landscape, but then you're gonna back out off of that, and you're gonna repeatedly kind of do that to kind of get that threshold higher, like you were saying. Sure. So I
love it.
100% agree with that. Let's move on here, wrap this up. I got a mulligan round.
Okay, here we go.
Essentially a series of questions that I ask. I'll skip some of the golf ones since you aren't a golfer.
I know. Yeah, I saw you said something about a club. I was like, I don't know.
But what I'll
say, three iron. I hate those things. I don't know. Like.
Yeah. So what I say is, you know, just give me your first thought, reaction, whatever, and you can skip one if you'd like. That's your mulligan.
Okay.
All right. So let's see here. What would you pick for your superhero power?
I like to absorb others' powers. And then I can reflect the power back on them. I think that's a brilliant power to have. I don't know. I think it exists. I think there's some like obscure X-Men person that had it, but
Rogue.
Yeah. Not obscure at all. No. Like, but I feel like that to me is like the obvious power you'd want. Like then you have them all.
Yeah. I don't know.
You can. So I think that'd be the winner to me.
That's pretty cool. I haven't had that one before. So that's good. What's your go-to karaoke song?
Oh shoot. Oh man, let's see. I'm a big 90s hip hop guy, so I don't know if there's a lot of mini karaoke. You know, if there was a karaoke 90s rap song, I think it would be Fresh Prince, Summertime.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that'd be, I mean, I know it's not singing, but who doesn't like that song?
No, that's all good. Instead of golf term, let's go with what's the weirdest, you know, lifting term or name for an exercise that you've had?
For a name of an exercise. Oh man, actually it was funny to me. It's not weird, but to my clients, it's weird. Like last night I had one of my clients, do a Spanish squat.
Yeah.
And to her, she was like, why is this called a Spanish? And for those who don't know what a Spanish squat is, you're essentially wrapping one end of a band around a pole or a bar, and the other ends are behind your knees. And you're leaning back and you're holding a goblet or a dumbbell in front of you and you're squatting. And the idea is you got a vertical lower leg and you just put more emphasis on your quads. And with her, I said, oh, these are Spanish squats. And she was like, why are these called? And I had no answer. I don't know why they're called Spanish squats, but.
Why are Romanian deadlifts called Romanian deadlifts?
True. Yeah. Like or Bulgarian split squats called. That would be my pick just because it came up last night.
All right. What's your favorite exercise or drill?
Just in general?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I love deadlifts. So I think that the deadlift is what's great about it is that you can contort the individual. You can contort the lift to the individual, not the individual to the lift. So there's many iterations of the deadlift that, you know, all I'm looking at is to train the hip hinge. I call it the Einhorst Finkel's Einhorn. I don't know if you're familiar with Ace Ventura of Jim Carrey back in the day.
I've seen that in forever.
but like, because people think deadlift, like people just inherently think, oh, deadlift, heavy barbell on the ground, you're deadlifting it or you're picking it off the ground. It's like, no, I want to train the hip hinge. So there are many ways I can train that, and that doesn't mean it could be with a kettlebell, it could be with a trap bar, it could be with a dumbbell, it could be with a cable system. So that's really, I really just like the versatility of the lift.
All right. What's the takeaway you want everybody to get from today's conversation?
That trainable menu. Like that to me is like the big umbrella theme that I really try to instill on fitness professionals in particular, because we're the ones that are dosing our programs and sets and reps and rest periods, but, just trying to convey that message to them at which they can convey it to their clients. Like, okay, you have a hangnail. We can still train. Let's go. Like,
right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Awesome. Well, Tony, before we wrap up here, let us know how we can follow you and kind of learn more about you.
So that would be, my website, which is my name. So tonygentlecore.com. That's my blog. As you noted, I have many blog posts, all my articles from other various websites, but also, podcasts, resources, social media, my own products that I sell on there. So that would be the easiest place to get a hold of me.
All right. We'll make sure we get that in the show notes, you guys. Thank you. So you guys can check that out. That's it for this episode of the Golf Under Par podcast. We will have that information in the below. And thank you so much for all listening. And thank you, Tony, for coming on.
Remember, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Remember, simple consistency leads to greatness.
Thank you guys for listening to this episode. Hopefully you've enjoyed this content on the go. If you found it helpful, please share with a friend and leave us a review on iTunes. This allows us to reach more golfers just like you that want to play under par. Do you want to be stronger and healthier? Well, I've got a resource, Golf Fitness Tips. It's a free Facebook group where we talk about how to take care of our bodies so that we can play more golf, we can play golf longer in life, and we can play better on the course. If that interests you, then check out the link below or search for Golf Fitness Tips on Facebook.